Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We have a theme this week, storytelling, in some of its many forms, from folktale to song to stage, public display, and journalism. We'll begin with some background. Jean-Marie Rouillet-Willoughby is a professor of Russian studies, folklore, and linguistics at the University of Kentucky, and she is past president of the Kentucky World Languages Association. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Rouillet-Willoughby.
Thank you, Tom. I'm happy to be here.
Eastern Kentucky is a place where very colorful legends are born and endure from generation to generation. Storytelling is more or less ingrained in the regional cultural DNA. Why do we do this? Why do we tell, and why do we enjoy hearing stories?
Essentially, for me, stories are a way of capturing our experiences in ways that speak to who we are as social and cultural creatures. And it's a type of sharing that can't really be replaced by stories that we see, for example, on TV, because stories on TV are fixed, or in films. They're fixed and they're given to us and we can't interact with them. But in a storytelling session, what happens is you get storytellers who tell variants of stories that speak to them and speak to their audiences, and people interact in fundamental ways that help explain their experience and characterize their experience for people.
Well, as you alluded to there before, we have all these platforms for storytelling: books, film, video, radio, podcasts, and so on. But given that there are annual storytelling festivals in Moorhead, Wilmore, and Paris, all around Kentucky, in-person storytelling as a performing art seems to be thriving. Why do you think that particular form endures?
I think part of it is the human connection, which is especially good after the pandemic. Part of it is also, I guess nostalgia is the best word for it, a desire for connecting to roots. We see that a lot in people who live in the 21st century urban environment, who take their kids, for example, to state fairs and interact with the farmers and look at the animals and the plants and all those things. And it ties to a notion of who we are as Americans in this context, or Kentuckians, and what is our heritage and how do we keep it alive?
Is it generalizing to say that the assumption is that if it's folklore, it must be a tall tale? It can't be true. Is that so?
Yes. That is one of the fundamental misconceptions that I have to deal with my students and with anybody who talks to me about folklore. One of the things people say is, oh, well, you must know a lot of stories. Well, yeah, because I'm interested in story and I study stories as a specialist. But folklorists study both material culture, like weaving, instrument making, household design, clothing, as well as stories, as well as practices. So I'm a specialist in ritual practices as well as legends primarily. But when people say it's just folklore, they assume that what they're saying is it's fake. But folklore is not necessarily fake. These are fundamental premises about the way we understand the world based on our experience. So the story historically may not have every single detail if you went back into the historical record, but it's based on experiences that do happen to people, and we want to convey those experiences. So we may embellish, we may have, you know, faulty memories, we may have all these kind of things. But that doesn't matter, because it does to a historian, of course, or to a journalist. But to a folklorist, we're concerned with how people are perceiving the world and what the truths they're trying to convey about their experience. So legends are particularly fraught in this regard, because the term urban legend has come to mean fake stuff. But urban legends are very often based on historical fact. They are a reflection of the reality that we live in. So you may dismiss a legend primarily because it's not part of your experience. It comes from outside your experience. When it comes from inside your experience, you're much more likely to say, oh, yeah, I understand that, and I believe that that happened, or to somebody, if not to you, to my friend's friend. You know, it's always a friend of a friend kind of thing. And it affects your behavior, can affect your behavior significantly because that truth has resonance for you.
Well, can the very same story mean different things to different people?
Yes, absolutely it can. In the case of a legend, it can be perceived as being very powerful or nonsense because of these different experiences that we've lived. But it also, one of the things that's powerful about stories is, I can give you an example from a Russian story that I teach in my Russian folklore class, where a mother-in-law telling the story, the variant she tells is usually that the daughter-in-law, because in the Russian traditional wedding system, so this is an old legend, the daughter would move into the husband's home. The daughter-in-law is a problem. She's an outsider. She's come in and she's causing trouble in the family. The daughter-in-law may tell the story that the mother-in-law is the problem. Mm-hmm. So the story is exactly the same plot. It's how, however, you characterize the people in it, what you're trying to convey, and what the actual meaning of the story is.
Well, as we talked about earlier, we have this innate need for narratives about who we are, where we come from, what we mean to each other. We tell stories because we're human, but are we also made more human because we tell stories?
Yes, I think so. I think folklore is perhaps the most underappreciated discipline, mainly because the study of these often unspoken cultural norms are so ingrained in who we are and so important to who we are, but we often can't even articulate them, that we lose sight of them until they're taken away from us, right? Like during the pandemic when we didn't have these kind of connections and we couldn't, it was not as easy to have our social life that folklore thrives upon. And so I think the more we share stories with each other, which is the goal of when I teach a course, I want them to not just share each other's stories or collect stories from their families or their regions or wherever they're from, but to understand how not to simply dismiss another person's story because it's not part of your experience, but to use that as a window into another type of human experience.
Jean Marie Rouillet-Willoughby is a professor of Russian studies, folklore, and linguistics at the University of Kentucky. She's past president of the Kentucky World Languages Association, and we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I always am happy to talk about stories.
Tell me a tale that always was. Sing me a song that I'll always hear.
Theater is all about storytelling. What if you have a good story that you think would translate well to the stage, but you're not sure how to make that happen? Well, there's a class for that, and it's one of the programs offered by the Lexington Theater Company. And with me here in the studio is company co-founder and artistic director, Lindy Franklin. Welcome, Lindy.
Thanks, Tom. It's always so great to be here.
So you have something at the Lexington Theater Company that you call Story Cycle. Tell us about that.
There's many facets to our programming, but it all centers around this idea of storytelling and masterful storytelling. So elevated, giving you the tools and the techniques to tell your stories. Or maybe you just come and enjoy one of our stories that we put on stage in our main stage productions. But Story Cycle is a program that I'm so passionate about. It was actually birthed during the pandemic. And during the pandemic and sort of alongside the Black Lives Matter movement, there was a call in our industry for more inclusive storytelling, specifically in the theater, in the musical theater, and making sure that lots of stories are being told and that everyone, the beautiful fabric of our entire country can be represented on stage and people are seeing these stories, seeing themselves in these stories. And so as our team was sort of contemplating, you know, how can we help? How can we be a force of positive change? And we immediately thought about our young people. And we felt like it was important to start with our youth and to help them to have the tools and the confidence to tell their stories. And so we launched Story Cycle. It's a free musical theater songwriting class. It's for high school students, no experience necessary. So you can have never sung a note or played the piano and come into this class. And by the end of an academic year with us, you have a published piece of work. So we're about to have our concert for this season, which will be recorded for a live album. And the, you know, the students of our Story Cycle classes past now can say, hey, look for me on Spotify. There's my song.
Oh,
and so
great.
it's a beautiful way to sort of give them a way to raise their voice in musical theater.
And that performance is on April 14th?
April the 14th. It's going to be at the Carrick Theater at Transylvania University. And what's also really cool about Story Cycle, again, kind of weaving in our mission at the Lex, we always are about combining seasoned professionals and up-and-coming students and rising stars. Of course, we think mm-hmm. we're all students of the craft. So, you know, in our main stage shows, we have these Broadway veterans and seasoned professionals coming in to work with the students. Well, the same thing carries through with all of our programs, including Story Cycle. So we have guest artists in residence. This year, it's Troy Anthony, who's actually a Louisville native and is working in the New York theater scene. He's had work at The Public and Seattle's Fifth Avenue, all kinds of really fantastic theaters. And so he's been working with the students virtually, kind of calling in and checking in with them through the year. And then he'll be here on the 14th. He's going to present a set of his original work. And the students will then present their set of their original work. So it's a whole evening of new works, a whole evening of storytelling, new stories presented by these students and then this guest artist in residence.
As for the classes themselves, are they still virtual?
For right now, yes. It was, again, this was something that we birthed during the pandemic. So at that point, we were all virtual. But one of the things that we found was that we are serving students all over Central Kentucky. So not just in Lexington, but several of the surrounding counties. And for some of those students, getting to Lexington once a week was a little bit of a barrier. So we've decided to keep it online for right now to make sure that it's as easy as, you know, hopping on the tablet or the Chromebook and you can log into class. What's amazing is what they are able to accomplish with this virtual class. So they meet virtually every week, and then they have a few meetups during the year in person with their teacher, Joseph Wrightson, and then they come together for their presentations. And it's remarkable. We just had their 10-minute musicals reading the other night, and they blew me away. I was a panelist just to give them some helpful hints, but they were already so far on their way of really getting to the heart of speaking to what young people are going through these days and turning it into mini musicals. It was breathtaking.
10-minute musicals. Tell me more about that.
So this is a new project just this year. This year's class is the first one to try it. In the past, they work on just a single song and working up to that. But this year, Joseph was like, I'm going to challenge them. We're going to put them in groups. And we're going to see if they can write a 10-minute musical. And the panel, they did a reading and I was there, Brock Terry, our resident music director, Brance Cornelius, who's our education coordinator. We were there to give them feedback. And we kept saying to the students, you know, in a regular book musical, in 10 minutes, we're usually still in the first sequence. We're still in the exposition. And what these students were able to do to create that arc to get us hooked around a protagonist with an obstacle and to tie it all up in 10 minutes was just remarkable. And each musical had about 3 to 4 songs. And the students played the roles. Some of them, they were self-accompanying. It was just phenomenal. And so many of them, you know, we were kind of looking at each other on the panel going, this could be developed. This could go on to something else. And that's sort of the dream. You know, we're just hoping we're planting the seeds and that some of these young people may go on to be the writers of the musicals we're seeing on Broadway and regionally all over the place in the future.
How many classes in this course? Story
So Story Cycle right now, it's just for high schoolers. Our dream is that it's going to grow and that we'll start working with middle schoolers sometime soon. But yeah, it's a small group. They have to apply. Again, there's no experience required. We just look for passion, you know, look for kids who are excited about musicals and storytelling and learning and applying themselves to creativity. And it's been phenomenal to watch students who have had very little previous training, what they've been able to create is just phenomenal.
You also have a storytelling through song adult workshop, and I think that's coming up April 29th.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So these are some workshops that we're working on. We're piloting another program that we're hoping is going to become part of our year-round education in our artist development program. So these little workshops are just sort of, again, we're planting the seeds. We're getting people sort of, you know, interested in it. But it's basically the idea is, how do you interpret a song as a performer? So these are not writing the songs. These are interpreting, because, you know, in the world of theater, musical theater, we sort of think of ourselves in kind of, there's two different camps. There's our creative artists that are writing the material, and then the interpretive artists who are taking what's written and interpreting it. And so this would be more for the interpretive artist who's interested in taking a piece that's already been written and finding the life in it, bringing that character to life, helping us to understand what it is that character wants, what's in their way. It's so much more music. This is why I love musical theater, is it's so much more than just singing the notes. It's also about what is the story that you're telling through that language, through how you're moving physically at the same time. So there's such a technique to it. And we wanted to kind of share that. And that class is specifically for adults. One of the things we're passionate about is lifelong learning. So a lot of times folks can think, oh, well, I loved musicals and I did my high school play, but then I majored in something else and I haven't touched that in a long time. But we say, no, we all should be playing. Adults should be playing. We all need that creative space. And so we're trying to kind of let our grown-ups, our serious adults with serious jobs, have a place to come and play and just to kind of process the material, to practice in a creative way, to step out of their comfort zone, do something new. I think folks will find it really energizing.
It's maybe a little too soon, but I just wondered, are you seeing things come from this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are the very tangible victories, I guess, or achievements where you can see your students kind of going on and doing big things. We have, goodness, like 8 or 9 of our alumni from our productions who are in Broadway shows this season. We have kids who are off at Governor School. We have kids who've come through the program and they're off studying theater in college. So those are, you know, sort of really easy to kind of say, wow, okay, that's really amazing that they achieved that. But what I love are the sort of smaller victories and the smaller outcomes, just knowing that somebody's life feels more enriched, or they have stepped more fully into their creativity, or they finally feel like they have an outlet, or they finally have found their sort of tribe, you know, of folks that they are like, these are my theater people. Let's walk arm in arm through this life together. Those are the things that fill my cup. And just watching our students flourish. And when I say students, literally lifelong students of the craft, we have students from 5 to over 55 in our programs. And that's the other thing that is so beautiful too, is watching the multi-generational learning that's happening. And the same way that our older students are looking at our kindergarten first graders and going, oh, they're so cute. And the kindergarten first graders are looking up at our trailblazers and saying, wow, I want to be that when I grow up. And that's the most beautiful part of it all, because we all have a story and we all are artists. And it's just about making sure that we're giving ourselves the gift of a place to play and a gift of the place to practice our craft, no matter the age, no matter the stage. It's for everybody.
Well, I'm going to ask you to tell a little bit of a story. We're going to go out with some music, Unspoken, which was downloaded from the LexingtonTheaterCompany.org is your website. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that, Lindy.
So Unspoken was the song cycle from last year's Story Cycle class. And again, these are all original works by these young people. They're sort of speaking to the issues of their generation. They're each super unique and wonderful. I encourage you to listen to the whole album. It's wonderful. Enjoy.
Where can it be found?
You can go right to our website, LexingtonTheaterCompany.org, but you can also find it on Bandcamp, where a purchase of the album goes back to help support the Lex and the Story Cycle program, and you can also find it on Spotify.
Lindy Franklin, co-founder and artistic director of the Lexington Theater Company. Thanks for coming in, Lindy.
Thank you, Tom.
The Paris Story Fest is happening on the weekend of May 12th through the 14th this year. Festival organizer Mary Lovell is in the studio with us. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Mary.
Thank you, Tom.
And also, hello to Sheila Arnold, who's joining us from Fort Myers, Florida. Hi, Sheila.
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
Doing really good. And we'll get to the details, Mary, about this year's event in just a few minutes. But first, I'd like to ask you to tell us what it is about storytelling as a performing art that attracts you enough to do all the work of organizing this annual event.
Well, I'll tell you right off that it was Sheila's idea, not mine, but I love storytelling. My husband Jim and I have been going to the International Storytelling Festival, for at least 40 years.
Wow.
So it's really been fun. We just enjoyed stories with just sitting and listening because it's so unlike television. It's so unlike drama. It is kind of like drama.
Would you say it's theater of the mind?
Yes. Yes, I would.
Let's talk about this year. What are the highlights of this year's festival?
Well, the highlights are many. Every year we try to get a little bit better. This is our 7th year of producing a festival. And every 2 years we have Bill Lepp. We give him 1 year off, but he is a star performer. He has been all over the United States, and he is hilarious. He is so funny and so laid back, and we just love him. We have Sheila Arnold, who is online with us today, so I will let her tell you what she does. We have Hippa White, who is coming from Nebraska, and she is a historian, and a lot of her stories are about life in the United States, the orphan train, immigrants at Ellis Island, and she does a lot of historical factual stuff. And Josh Goforth is a musician. He plays almost 20 instruments, and he is fantastic, but he's the one that tells a lot of family stories. And then we have Mary Hamilton, who is our Kentucky prize, I should say. She does the story by story every month, beginning in March, I think, all the way to October. She brings in top names from throughout the United States, and it's always in Frankfort. But she does a fantastic job in promoting storytelling throughout Kentucky.
Okay, and this festival, of course, is in Paris, in Bourbon County. Where will it be happening in Paris?
Well, we use lots of different venues. We start out in the schools on Friday morning, and we spend all day at the Bourbon County schools, the Paris schools, St. Mary's, and even Nicholas County. And then in the evening, we have adult storytelling. And this year it will be at the Oasis, which is down on Main Street. We'll accommodate a lot more people, but it has an open bar. So adults are invited, not children. Then beginning on Saturday, we go to the Trackside Restaurant for breakfast with Bill Lepp and Mary Hamilton. And then we go to Chief Reed Park, which is on the western end of town. And Sheila will be telling stories there. We have a jam session at Hopewell Museum with Josh Goforth. Claiborne Farm has opened up to a private tour for our storytellers, anyone who's coming to the event. And Pippa White will be telling a horse story before the tour there. We have a showcase at the Arboretum, which is the Wallace House, the Kentucky State Arboretum, as well as the Garden Club of Kentucky. And so all the tellers will be telling there. And then we have a dinner that night at the Arboretum.
And for the breakfast and for the dinner, do you need to make reservations?
Yes. They can go to our website, which is Paris Story Fest, and sign up there. But now the breakfast, they have to make reservations through the Trackside restaurant. And the reason being that she charges for the breakfast. We do not charge for the storyteller. So anybody that wants to just come hear the storytellers can bring a chair.
All right.
No problem.
Well, Sheila Arnold has been waiting patiently on the line. Sheila, tell us how you got into spinning yarns in the first place.
Well, spinning yarns, I love that terminology, you know, that we think of speech and words as yarns that are pulled together. And when we knit them together, then they become something beautiful or something that you actually hated that your aunt made for you that you're forced to wear. So one or the other. I came to storytelling through parents that were great storytellers, always at our kitchen table. I mean, always at our dining room table, telling stories, encouraging us to tell stories, mostly family ones and things of the day that we experienced. And then I eventually had a child when I was, I did a lot of stories and telling stories in theater for a long time. And then I had a son, and I used to go visit his class and as a preschooler. And I got tired of them giving me books to read that seemed really silly. And so I just told the kids the stories that that I told my son at home. And I sang the songs that I sang to my son at home. And people started asking me, where did I get those from? And I told them I made them up, because that's what I thought all parents did. And I quickly found out that was not. And so I continued to be asked from one place to the other. Every school he went to, I shared more stories and continued to be asked to come to other places. Eventually, I worked at Colonial Williamsburg in Williamsburg, Virginia, and they paid me to tell stories, which was great. And then in 2003, God opened a door and said, it's time for you to walk out and do that. So 20 years now, I have been telling stories. And when I first started out that door, I told my son, who was then 17, going to be 18, and told him that if I did that, it would be a tough senior year he would have. And my son looked at me and said, do what you always should have been doing. And my parents, I asked them for help if I decided to do this for bills, because I didn't know how I was going to do that. And my parents also said, do what you should have always been doing. And that's what I've been doing for 20 years.
Oh, that's a good family you have there.
I do. And they have felt the, you know, I do make a living off of this. It's, you know, which is just stunning that I get to share story, and it's an honor to be able to do such. So, yes, and they've been very proud of what I've done. So I'm pleased.
Do you find that you're something of a story idea sponge? I mean, when you're in conversation with people, are you listening for ideas?
I don't mean to be, but sometimes I am. Sometimes it's not so much that I'm listening for ideas, but then I'll hear something over, you know, kind of over to the side and go, ooh, I got to write that one down.
Well, are you watching the audience for reaction as you're telling your stories?
I am, although I've become more careful. It's taken 20 years. So I used to watch the audience and, you know, I was looking for every sign, you know, do they like it? Do they hate it? Are they sleeping? Are they snoring? Are they, you know, talking to one another? And just every movement was a sign to me of something. I've gotten away from that, which is really good, because that doesn't mean anything. The first time that I think I really walked away is I was doing a performance in Navajo land and called the Diné, the Diné people. And so after the performance, it was very stoic and no one clapped. And I was like, ooh. Well, at least you could clap for me. And then the woman that invited me said, we don't clap. It is the highest honor if we are not clapping. And then they proceeded to clap for me a little bit, which, you know, to help me, not for their own purposes. And so I stopped pretty much around that time and just went, you know, I don't need to look to the audience. I need to trust the story. And when I can trust the story is doing what it's supposed to do, I'll find out afterwards if it worked or didn't work. But if I'm doing the story well, I can even hold on to just doing the story well.
Well, I love it. A storyteller telling a story about storytelling. This is great.
Yeah.
coming back to Mary here, Mary Lovell here in the studio. Mary, what would you say is your favorite thing about this, about storytelling?
About storytelling?
Mm-hmm.
probably like, although Sheila may not agree, but I love to watch the reaction of the people in the audience. And I like to see, we get so many thank you notes from people around town and people who come into Paris that say, thanks for having a storytelling festival. And that's what encourages me.
All right, that's Mary Lovell of the Paris Storytelling Fest and professional storyteller Sheila Arnold with us on the phone from Fort Myers, Florida. And again, the festival is happening this year in Paris on May 12th through the 14th. And thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For information about storytelling events across the Commonwealth, visit kystory.org.
Tell me a tale that always was.
Coming up after the break, the rules of storytelling and journalism, an actual news story about something happening in Whitesburg, and the stories told by a museum. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
I'm Brian Burkhart with coming events by the Kentucky Arts Council. April 24th, the Kentucky Arts Council will host Kentucky Writers Day at the State Capitol in Frankfort. This year's Writers Day will feature the installation of the 2023-2024 Kentucky Poet Laureate. For more information on Writers Day, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. On April 15th at 7 p.m., Gateway Regional Arts Center in Mount Sterling will host the new Beckham County Ramblers as part of the Wood Songs Coffee House Concert Series. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit grackentucky.org. And Heinemann Settlement School will host Troublesome Creek Writers Retreat April 21st through the 23rd, featuring award-winning Kentucky author Silas House as the retreat facilitator. For more information, visit Heinemann.org. For information to support these and other arts events in Kentucky, visit artscouncil.ky.gov.
We're back with more about storytelling. Journalism tells stories, the nonfiction, fact-based variety. Here's the latest in our series on the four pillars of the Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists. Our guests are a former Herald Leader managing editor and a member of the Kentucky Journalism Hall of Fame. Both are former presidents of the Bluegrass Chapter of the SPJ, and I'm its current president. Tom Eblen and Liz Hansen join us for a look at Pillar 3. Act independently. The highest and primary obligation of ethical journalism is to serve the public. And journalists should, and this is where we begin our conversation, avoid conflicts of interest, real or perceived, and disclose unavoidable conflicts. And we do that regularly at WEKU, and stories that we do that might involve somebody that is an underwriter as well of the station. Have you encountered that in print journalism?
Well, it's pretty standard procedure that, for instance, that reporters, news reporters, and even columnists, you know, don't put political signs in their yards. They can't, you know, contribute to political candidates. You know, the idea is that we're observers and we're reporters. We're not partisans. And so there's some very strict rules about that in most every news organization, probably the best example.
And also, I think it's extremely important that when you can't avoid a conflict, that you acknowledge it, just as you said. You are the current president of the Society of Professional Journalists, and that was disclosed in preparing these programs.
We are to refuse gifts, favors, fees, free travel, special treatment, and avoid political and other outside activities that might compromise integrity or impartiality or might damage credibility. And that does happen, doesn't it? I mean, there are cases of reporters being wooed with a meal or a trip somewhere, that kind of thing.
Yeah, most regular news organizations have pretty strict rules about that. And the newspapers I worked for, basically, it was you couldn't accept anything of value. And value was kind of perceived as, you know, under $20 mm-hmm. or over $20 or something. It wouldn't keep a source from buying you a cup of coffee. But generally, for instance, you know, if you went to lunch with a source, you would pay, you know, and they would pay for themselves and you would pay for yourself. So, you know, even though such a small thing might not really be a conflict of interest, but it's just that whole perception. I think you want to make sure that not only are you not being influenced as a journalist, but if it were to become known, would the public, you know, perceive it differently?
One of the newspapers I worked for, I was on a features desk, and we had a policy: if somebody we had covered brought us a plate of cookies and we could eat it, then we could keep it. Any other thing beyond that was generally not acceptable.
We are to be wary of sources that offer information for favors or for money, and not to pay for access to news and to interviews, and that has happened from time to time. We're to identify content provided by outside sources, whether paid or not. How often does this occur?
I think one thing that's happening in smaller newspapers now that are being have such short staff, they're so short-staffed, and it happened before, too, is a tendency to take press releases that come in and run them verbatim. The general rule in most newsrooms is you use that press release as a starting point for doing some reporting if it's newsworthy, instead of just putting the, something like the Herald News Service on the top of a prepared news release.
Yeah, because really one of the basic tenets of good journalism is that journalism is a discipline of verification. And if you're just running a press release without verifying the information in it, you're not being a journalist. You're being a publicity agent.
This is kind of where what's called native advertising comes in as well, isn't it? I've seen articles, for example, about logistics, the logistics industry, that seemed like a fairly legitimate article, but it turns out it was written by UPS Public Relations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the best books, I think, for people who are interested in what is good journalism is it's called The Elements of Journalism. And it's by two veteran journalists, Bill Kovich, who used to be my boss in Atlanta, and Tom Rosensteel, who is now, head of a journalism organization. He was a former media writer at the Los Angeles Times. But it really very succinctly, I think, describes what good journalism is. And the whole act independently is one of the real keys to that book.
We are to deny favored treatment to advertisers, to donors, or any other special interests, and resist internal and external pressure to influence coverage. And I'm just wondering, have either of you encountered that kind of pressure? And if you did, how'd you handle it?
I encountered it when I was actually the advisor to the Eastern Progress at Eastern Kentucky University. I, on more than one occasion, would get a call from someone who did not like the questions maybe a student reporter had been asking or didn't like the story that the student reporter was working on. And as the advisor, I would get the call that would say, we don't want that published. Can you make the students not do that? And my answer always was, I'm an advisor, not a dictator. The students are going to make their own calls on whether or not this is a newsworthy story.
And how was that received?
Not favorably, but we did it anyway.
Both newspapers I worked for at one time or another, and perhaps many times, would have, advertisers, particularly car dealers, seem to be bad about this. They would get upset about some coverage of, auto recalls or something, and withhold advertising, wanting more favorable coverage of the. And in both cases, I'm proud to say the publishers basically told them to take a hike and took, a lot of loss of advertising, because one of the jobs of a newspaper publisher is they're a business person, but all of the publishers I worked for had very strong journalism ideals. One of my favorite examples, when I was an editor in Atlanta, we had a very good commercial real estate reporter that did a expose on the fact that John Portman, who was then a very well-known developer and architect, was going broke. He was turning back a lot of properties to lenders, and she started writing about this. And his people, he was one of the most powerful people in Atlanta, and he came into the editor's office, one of his representatives, and basically the editor just kind of handed him his head on a platter and said, and by the way, you haven't talked to this reporter, do it on the way out. So it was a really good lesson in how newspapers, don't buckle under to powerful people.
And sometimes it's very costly for a newspaper to do that, particularly a small newspaper. I know of examples where if the local grocery store pulls their full-page ad for that week, that's the salary for a reporter that week. And so that economic pressure on small newspapers can be intense.
And advertisers often know that, don't they?
Yes.
Thanks to veteran journalists and ethics professors Tom Eblin and Liz Hansen. We'll be back next week with a look at Pillar 4 of the Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists. And if you'd like to read the whole document, you'll find it on our site at esweku.org. For Pillars 1 and 2, visit the Code of Ethics series tab at spjbluegrass.org.
I've got news for you. Things will never be the same.
Journalism, in this case, information shared by a seasoned observer, can tell a story about a good thing happening in a community, such as a story by Mountain Eagle reporter Sam Adams about a decision by the Double Quick convenience store chain to consolidate its headquarters in downtown Whitesburg, one of the communities hit so hard by last year's flooding.
Well, I think it'll be a game changer for downtown Whitesburg because there are about 80 employees. If you move 80 employees into the downtown area, that's got to create foot traffic and vehicular traffic for businesses. I look for some of the restaurants to either expand their hours or new restaurants to go in and maybe some other shops or something after this gets going a while.
Mountain Eagle reporter Sam Adams. Governor Beshear was recently in Whitesburg announcing nearly $2 million in grants, much of it earmarked for improving water and sewage systems in the area. Another form of storytelling, history, is Gerald Smith's focus in this latest in our series on racial justice and equality.
Akram Burton, executive director of the Kentucky Center for African American Heritage, has a very extensive resume and quite a bit of experience in post-secondary education, including the classroom, administration, executive planning, and media production. Akram's work as an educator, photographer, and media producer has taken him around the globe, and his works depicts people, places, and events in Brazil, China, Colombia, Cuba, Ghana, Haiti, Jamaica, Japan, Nigeria, Panama, Senegal, South Africa, Tibet, and countless places throughout the United States. He is a recipient of numerous recognitions and awards for his work as an educator and media artist, and has served on a number of different boards, including the African American Heritage Foundation Board. Mr. Burton, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, Gerald.
So today we're going to talk about the Kentucky Center for African American Heritage, and just sort of want to begin by introducing a lot of our listeners to the center. So exactly what is the Kentucky Center for African American Heritage? Where is it located? You can give us some background in terms of how it was established and how it is governed.
Yeah, we're located in Louisville, Kentucky, on Muhammad Ali Boulevard. In the center of the historic Russell community in West Louisville. I say historic, I could take the whole show just talking about the history of Russell community. But the center was actually started out as the African American Heritage Committee back in 1994, when a number of concerned scholars and artists, cultural workers, decided that they wanted to start to put up historic markers to commemorate people and places that are very important in Kentucky African-American history. They did such a good job. A lot of these markers that you see up in Louisville and around the state was actually initiated by this committee. And then people said, well, you know, you need your own space. And one thing led to another. And it turned out that where we're located, we're located in the old trolley barn, which was, you know, again, on Walnut Street, now Muhammad Ali Boulevard. At that point, the trolley barn was in disrepair. It was basically declared a brown field. So what we did was we hired an environmental specialist to determine what it would take to neutralize the dirt. And we did that. We found that that was doable. And the rest is history. And then what happened after that was that the two new bridges that were built here down in Louisville area was coming up online. And so an appropriation was made within that budget of $28 million to renovate this whole campus. We have four buildings. We have about 68,000 square feet. We do exhibitions, theatrical performances, musical performances of all types. We have family fun days, festivals, and then we also rent out as well. We have a number of people over the years that have rented our facilities for birthdays, weddings, bar mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs, you name it. Our mission is to preserve and promote Kentucky African-American heritage and the heritage that we share with the African diaspora. So we do all kinds of exhibits that educate the general public about Kentucky heritage, Kentucky history, but we also do exhibits about the African diaspora. We've had exhibits and presentations from people from Cuba, from Costa Rica, from South Africa, on down the list, Nigeria, and we continue to do so.
I was just up there a few weeks ago, and I noticed that you had a new exhibit that's on display now. You want to say something about that one?
We constructed a set designed for visitor experience that we developed. In fact, we're in the process of developing a series of visitor experiences that educate people about Walnut Street and the contributions that Walnut Street made. And Ed Hamilton's mother and father had a barbershop on 6th and Walnut Street, now Muhammad Ali Boulevard. And Ed saved all of the furniture that was in that barbershop. It's actually being housed at the Kentucky Historical Society. I contacted Scott Alvey, who is the executive director there, and we worked out an agreement where we have half of the furniture on loan to us. And we created a set. And right now we use that set to tell a story about Mary Ann Fisher. Mary Ann Fisher was a vocalist that sang with Ray Charles. She traveled the world with Ray Charles. She was with him for about 3 years and then left and went out on her own. But the interesting thing about it is the way she got her notoriety, she won a talent contest at the Lyric Theater. And the Lyric Theater was right next door to your valet shop, which was the name of the barbershop, Ed Hamilton's mother and father's barbershop. And I may note that Ed Hamilton's mother was the barber. His father was the tailor. And it was a family-run business. The uncles, the cousins, everybody were involved. They had a shoe shine, they had hairdressing, they had barbering, they had tailoring. They even had a pool spot there. People used to hang out. It was a one-stop shop. So we used that as the backdrop. What better thing to use but a barbershop to tell stories about the past?
And just a word about who Ed Hamilton is, you know, if you just kind of share with listeners, because this business is in Louisville, Kentucky.
Ed Hamilton is a rock star to us here. He's a sculptor. He has many sculptors around the country, Washington, D.C., Detroit. He has several here, and he's a renowned sculptor and very humble brother. And he grew up on Walnut Street. He attributes his success to Walnut Street because many people came through that barbershop. I mean, professional doctors, lawyers, you name it. So Ed was exposed at a very, very young age to what success looked like.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. Well, that's one of the things that I know that, you know, you want to do is to make sure that everyone is aware of the existence and location of the Kentucky Center for African American Heritage. It is located in Louisville. How long have you been executive director now?
I've been executive director for 7 years now, but I've been involved with the institution since 2000 when I came here to be an educational administrator in Jefferson County Public Schools. Mm-hmm. But I want to add something to this conversation, and that is that even though we're based in Louisville, we are a state institution. In 2011, Governor Beshear signed into law Senate Bill 64, making us a quasi-state agency. So we have a seat on the Kentucky Tourism, Arts, and Heritage Cabinet, and I meet periodically with agency heads on that cabinet. Agency heads include Kentucky Center for the Arts, the Arts Council, the Horse Park Exposition Center, the Berea Arts and Crafts Center, Arts Council, Humanities Council. all anything that has to do with arts, heritage, or tourism as represented on that cabinet. So we work very closely with organizations around the state. We want to strengthen that, and that's why I was really eager to be on your program, because I know your program has a wide reach. So we're trying to come up with strategies in which we can begin to connect with other institutions around the state, other scholars around the state that may have information about Kentucky African-American heritage.
Why is the center necessary? You know, given the fact that we have these other institutions around the state of Kentucky, why is it necessary to have a Kentucky Center for African-American Heritage?
Well, the obvious response to that is just turn on the news and you listen to, you know, commentators and people talking about pretty much silencing our history or, you know, banning particular books. Institutions like ours are important. As many institutions as we can create, I think, is very critical at this time because, you know, in order to move forward, you must look back. You must understand the trials and tribulations and challenges of the past, all right, so that generations to come will be able to navigate challenges that come before them. And also to understand that they stand on the shoulders of people who were very successful in overcoming the challenges and obstacles and what have you. We basically create a story told from the lion's perspective, not the hunter's perspective.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us the address of the Kentucky Center for African American Heritage again?
Yeah.
And the hours that you are open?
Yeah, we're at 1701 West Muhammad Ali Boulevard in Louisville, Kentucky. We're open Monday through Friday, 10 to 5. And some weekends when we have events and what have you, if people are interested in knowing more about what we do, I would recommend that they go to our website, which is kcaah.org, or they can like us on our Facebook page or Instagram as well as LinkedIn. But if you're very, very interested in knowing more about us and what we do and upcoming events, go to our front page and just drop your name and email address, and you'll be automatically added to our email blast.
All right. Well, thank you. That's Mr. Akram Burton, Executive Director of the Kentucky Center for African American Heritage. I'm Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. And thanks to Michael Kaiwanuka for Tell Me a Tale. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, Google News. Our RISE series about Eastern Kentucky flooding is available online at weku-rise.org. Also on Spotify and iTunes. Want to call our attention to something or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.